Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
How much does income inequality matter? It's another of the questions that you brought up in our conversation starters call in earlier this week, and it's one of the most important questions facing our country today and for the presidential election. Here is how our caller, Craig in Brooklyn, framed it on Tuesday's show. First, his own opinion.
I tend to be suspicious of income inequality because let that Supreme Court case show that whose name escapes me right now, where you can contribute to corporations as much as you want and it not like you were an individual. Well, one thing about income inequality when wealth is concentrated at the top is that you get to influence things.
You get to influence things. So wealth equals power. Unequal wealth equals unequal power. And then Craig acknowledged the other side.
If there wasn't a way to reward people with for their ingenuity and their creative and scientific and athletic and creative pursuits, there would just be a blandness to the performance, and that wherever income inequality has been forced in other parts of the world, it usually leads to economic stagnation.
So thank you, Craig, from Brooklyn, for suggesting the idea and asking for it to be a conversation, a back and forth. And now we'll search for the answer. In style, we were able to get two leading advocates in the field who happen to be debating this very question tonight under the auspices of the Manhattan Institute here in New York. Jared Bernstein, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Now, from 2009 to 2011, he was Vice President Biden's chief economist and executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class. And in this corner, Tim Winship, economic studies fellow at the Brookings Institution, who has also looked deeply into this question. He was previously the research manager for the Pew Charitable Trust Economic Mobility Project. Thank you both so much for doing this here this morning. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And let's get your takes first on how much economic inequality there is in this country today and whether it's getting worse. Jared Bernstein, want to go first. How much inequality, how much is the gap widening? Take a minute or a couple of minutes to lay it out.
Sure. Hey, and thanks for inviting me on the show. I'm a big fan of your show. I used to live up there.
Thank you.
By the way, it's Scott Winship, not Tim Winship.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know where I got that. Sorry.
Hello, Scott. Okay, so I think probably the best way to look at this is to reflect on the fact that if you go all the way back to the post-war periods, that's as far back as the reliable income data go, and you track the earnings of low, middle, and high-income families, you'll find that between the mid-40s and the mid-70s, they grow, all three of those groups grew at about the same rate. They just about doubled from the mid-40s to the mid-70s. And if you were to plot those lines on a graph, they'd be one on top of each other. And then if you continued plotting them through today, you'd find those lines separate out. They all of a sudden, they look like the tendrils of a jellyfish, all kind of going in different directions. The line for the 95th percentile, so 95% of families earn less, only 5% earn more, climbs quite steeply. The middle or the median income is fairly stagnant. They had a nice little growth burst in the 1990s, which is actually be worth talking about, but generally stagnant otherwise than that. And in fact, in the 2000s, they actually lost ground, despite the fact that there was an economic expansion. That's middle-income people. And of course, folks at the bottom have done the worst. If you then take out taxes and you include the value of health care, I think people like Scott, for good reasons, like to make a lot of adjustments to these data to try to make sure you're not cooking the books, be as inclusive as you can, you actually get a pretty similar result. After-tax income for the top 1% grew by almost a factor of 4 from the late 70s till now. If you look at the bottom, say 20%, that was up well under 1% per year over that period, about 18% overall. So that's the lay of the land.
So, Scott Winship, do we have a debate on the facts or only on the meaning of the facts?
First of all, thank you for inviting me onto the show. I'm a real fan as well. I do think we have a debate on both the facts and the consequences of the facts. So what I would say about what has happened over time, Jared's absolutely right that in the mid-20th century there was broadly shared growth through the 1960s. And then there's been, in a sense, a big slowdown since that point. But that's actually true around the world. What's distinct about what's happened in the U.S. is that the richest households in the U.S. have had much bigger gains than in other countries, and so inequality has increased. The gains at the very top, the top 1% that have been in the news for a while now, have been incredibly impressive. And they've really pulled away from everybody else. But what's interesting is that if you look at inequality between the middle, the median household, and, say, the bottom 10%, that actually hasn't increased, potentially going as far back as the 1950s. So if what we're really concerned about with inequality is that it's creating unequal opportunities, in some sense, that's a more important measure. And that is not getting worse. And the other thing I would say is it's not that it's not that simply the middle class and the poor are doing badly. The numbers that Jared cites, tend to be lower than I think some of the best research out there. For instance, the Congressional Budget Office has put out figures showing that incomes at the middle have grown by 35% since 1979, which is, to be clear, slower than in previous decades. But Jared claims that increase has only been about 18%. Mm-hmm. Half as much. So are
those numbers adjusted for?
Let me clarify. I want to clarify what I said, okay. Which I thought I said clearly, but let me say again. Citing the exact same numbers that Scott is citing, I was talking about the bottom 20%. The bottom 20%, according to the CBO numbers, which are generally, I disagree with Scott on this point, generally agreed to be very high-quality analysis. I mean, Scott's an outlier if he says they're not. They're up 18% from 79 to 2007. If you look at the middle 60%, so the bottom 20% up 18%, let's call it 20%. If you look at the middle 60%, they're up twice that much, 38%. Let's call it 40. So Scott's wrong if he says the middle is doing the same as the bottom. The middle 60% up 40%, the bottom 20% up half that much.
So Jared, and I don't want to get too bogged down.
Well, we got to get the facts straight.
So Scott, come back one more time on this, and then I want to move on to the meaning of whatever gap exists.
Sure. Well, I mean, when I was citing the evidence that inequality between the middle and the bottom hasn't increased, the Congressional Budget Office, the reports that I think Jared and I are both talking about, a typical way of measuring inequality is to look at the ratio of incomes between the folks in the middle and the folks at the bottom. And the Congressional Budget Office actually is consistent with the rest of the research in showing that since 1979, there hasn't been much of an increase in the ratio of those two numbers. So I'm not sure how we're
I'm looking right at the report, and I get 40% for the middle 60 and 18% for the bottom 20. So I guess we'll have to square that offline somehow. But I'm sorry, we're bringing you different reads of exactly the same information.
Well,
but
and that's part of the debate, and that's part of what happens in life. People see the same things through different eyes and come to different conclusions. Now, listeners, we do want your voices on this. The question on the table is, how much does income inequality in America today matter? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Jared Bernstein and Scott Winship, or you can post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Jared, would income inequality not matter if the middle and the bottom were sufficiently good? For example, you could have an economy, at least in theory, that generates fantastic wealth for the top 1%, grotesque wealth for the top 1%, but also has rising living standards and a growing middle class and a decent bottom for the poor. Does income inequality not matter in that case?
I think in that case it matters less, but it still matters. And you raise an important point that I should stress. I mean, Scott and I have this disagreement about some facts here, but we both agree that the top has pulled away. And the reason it matters is in the following sense. What we have seen, and you heard me describe that earlier period with where incomes were growing together before they started growing apart. In the earlier period, the average growth rate, take the growth rate of GDP, the economy expands every year a couple of percent. If the average growth rate is pretty much the growth rate that each family at each income group achieves, you're going to have the kind of growing together dynamic. If inequality functions as a diversion, such that the growth kind of does an end run around low or middle income families, their income will go up as it has, as we've been discussing, but it will be going up a lot less than everybody else's. So then it becomes a question, which is I like the way you and the caller earlier framed this, and it becomes a question of, well, how much does that matter? And I think it matters to the extent that it begins to block the opportunities of people, particularly in the bottom half of the income scale. If inequality and the diversion of economic growth away from middle and low-income families gets to the extent, and I would argue that it has, that it begins to impact and impinge upon the opportunities, educational opportunities, health opportunities, quality of life opportunities, neighborhood opportunities, begins to impact people on that level, then I think we have a problem, and I would argue, and I have evidence, and I'd be happy to cite it, of course, that we're there.
Scott, you want to react to that specifically?
Well, again, I think we do agree on a point, which is that we're both concerned about inequality of opportunity. I think where we disagree is about whether the evidence is compelling that income inequality, rising income inequality, has worsened opportunity. So, for instance, two really easy cuts are, you know, as inequality has increased, has intergenerational mobility declined. And the evidence, tends to show that whatever changes have happened in intergenerational mobility or in within-generation mobility.
And can I just jump in and say by intergenerational mobility, the ability of the next generation to do better than their parents, or are they locked into the same income group that their parents were in, correct?
That's right. So, and that's a good distinction. So if the question is just, did you end up better off than your parents in absolute terms, there's not actually been that much research on that, except that we know that over time, successive generations have ended up better off in absolute terms than their parents. Most of the research has been focused on this idea of, if you start in the bottom, are you stuck in the bottom? Or if you start at the top, do you remain at the top? And that research tends to show very small changes over time. To the extent that we really, if there have been changes, we've been unable to detect them with the available data so far. That's true of income, of earnings, of occupational mobility, by the way, also inconsistent evidence on educational mobility. Another aggregate cut is if you look across countries at their mobility levels and their inequality levels, you do see a pretty strong correlation. But it turns out you also see a pretty strong an equally strong correlation if you just compare countries' population size to their mobility levels. And so I and others have argued that this is actually incredibly weak evidence. It's something you learn in any social science undergraduate major, that correlation doesn't equal causation. If you stack wealth inequality against mobility, you actually get zero relationship across countries. So I think whether you're looking at those kind of aggregate correlations or whether you're drilling down to evidence at the individual level, the evidence just isn't that strong that inequality has actually worsened opportunity.
Jared, go ahead.
Well, Scott didn't really present any evidence, which, is kind of problematic. I think the fact that mobility, the idea that people are kind of changing places in the income scale, that the pace of that hasn't increased, is all you need to know. It's certainly not offsetting this higher levels of inequality that we've been talking about. I think if you want to look at evidence, you've got to get a lot more granular than that. Here are a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. And by the way, I want to agree with Scott that there is not a silver bullet that I'm going to offer you here that says conclusively, absolutely, beyond a doubt inequality is thwarting opportunity. But I'm going to give you some pretty good circumstantial evidence, which is about as far as we get in social science. If you look at the amount of money that families at different income levels can spend on their kids, what we call enrichment expenditures, music lessons, art lessons, books, sports, tutoring, things like that. If you go back a couple of decades before inequality took off, the ratio of low-income to high-income families, or I should say of high to low-income families in terms of these enrichment expenditures, was about a factor of four. High-income families spent about four times that of low-income families on enrichment expenditures for their kids, which are known to give their kids kind of a head start, as it were. If you pull forward to the era when inequality has been amplified so much, that factor of four has grown to a factor of seven. And if you then look at a corollary of that, the fraction of students who have completed college by income group, the gap between completion rates for low-income and high-income kids has grown by something like 15 percentage points. So you begin to see how these inequality factors work perniciously into the opportunities of kids. There's a great cover story in the Washington Post the other day that really struck at this point. It said because of all of these budget cuts, and D.C. has a real problem with our public school system, if because of all of these budget cuts, school systems are turning to parents to make up for the loss of budgets at the local level. And they turn to the parents and they say, you need to have an auction, a bake sale. You know, we all do this. I got kids in elementary school. We do this all the time. Well, just as you'd expect, as inequality has exploded, the rich neighborhoods are raising hundreds of thousands. The poor neighborhoods are raising literally hundreds. And that kind of a difference is a good example of the way inequality worms its way into opportunities. It's not conclusive social science, you know, regression analysis, and we don't have that yet. And Scott's right about that. But I think it's very indicative.
We have to take a break. We'll continue in a minute with Jared Bernstein, who is just speaking, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was Vice President Biden's chief economist and executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class from 2009 until last year, and Scott Winship, economic studies fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was previously the research manager for the Pew Charitable Trust Economic Mobility Project. And we'll start to fold in your calls as we continue to explore this question suggested by one of you the other day. How much does economic inequality matter? Stay with us. And we continue now with the conversation that came out of that conversation starter suggestion segment on does income inequality matter, with Jared Bernstein and Scott Winship on two different sides of this question. And we'll start taking your calls now. Kenny in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello, Kenny.
Hi, Brian. It seems to me like the more government social programs are adopted, the greater the gap between the rich and the poor working class are. I wanted to ask, what role do government or social programs play in the mobility of the poor working class?
Thank you very much. Scott Winship, you want to take that first?
Sure. Well, government transfer programs and tax expenditure programs, too, when poor people get refundable tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit, do reduce inequality a fair amount. Now, they do it less over time than they used to because it turns out that a lot of transfer payments, in the federal transfer payments anyway, go to senior citizens who are often not necessarily lower income. But it's certainly the case that in any given year, they do reduce inequality quite a bit.
Jared, anything briefly on that?
Just briefly, there's a table I'm looking at, and one of the co-authors is this crazy guy named Scott Winship, so I'm not quite sure what to make of it. But if you look at the effect of some of these interventions that target poor people that are quite granular, that get there's something called the Nurse Family Partnership, which is home visiting by nurses. There's preschool. There's whole school reform. There's learning programs for disadvantaged kids. The increase in lifetime earnings in these programs runs from about $20,000 to over $100,000. So they tend to have quite a big bang for their buck, and I think they also help offset some of this disadvantage and opportunity that we've been discussing.
Ankit in Edison, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, a big-time listener. I think the conversation to me would be a lot more different if, you always hear they call it consumer-driven economy. I think it's not as driven by the consumer as it is consumed, that, where we just consume more and more and more and more products, where we take on more credit, we take on more debt, we have to work the extra job, work the extra hours. If we demanded higher quality products and also demanded that higher quality services be offered from the United States as they are being offered by other countries, and even when products come from China or come from wherever, demand that are they being at a higher quality, because other countries do offer that, but we don't take that. And the same thing goes with our food and everything else. If you look into it and research it, or if you start asking questions or call the companies, be like, what are you doing? What is made in America? What is, do these have these chemicals? Do they have this? Then things will start to change, and, you would see a whole different conversation happening.
Ankit, thank you. I'm going to go right to the next caller, Bob in Mountainside. Bob, you're on WNYC.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Isn't since the mid-70s, the formation of single-family households skewed this data completely? And also, Dr. Thomas Sowell from the Stanford Hoover Institute has written extensively on this. And the quality of life has dramatically improved for the lower income percentage people. And also, globalization has increased the market for the upper income people, so it's also skewed the data. Please comment on those.
Thank you, Jared. How about when we get to talking about policy solutions, we can talk about the Buffett rule, so that richer people pay at least 30% of their income in taxes and whatever it might be. People on the right will more tend to bring up what Bob just did, which is that a lot of the inequality is being driven by family breakdown. And so family households with children but one parent are much more likely to be poor, and there are a lot more of them than there used to be, and that we need to look at that too.
Yeah, I think much of what Bob said is a little bit true and largely kind of talking points that are pretty misleading. The Congressional Budget Office data I was citing is adjusting for family size, so you got the results that Scott and I were talking about with those adjustments. Now, it's definitely the case that once you make those adjustments, things look better in terms of income growth than they would otherwise, but if you just track, a married couple family with two kids, it's one of the things I've done over time, you see that they fall prey to the very kinds of income stagnation that other middle-class families have faced. I think the point on quality of living is also easy to kind of make sound convincing when it's not all that convincing, at least to me. There's absolutely truth to the fact that, and Scott mentioned that as the economy increases on average, kind of per capita income increases on average, people are better off. I mean, we all have smartphones now. We all have air conditioning. We all have refrigerators. That tends to be what, color TVs, and that tends to be what a lot of people cite when they want to make this case. What they don't cite are things that have gone up in relative price. If you look at the kind of child care that poor people can afford, it's often subpar, and that's something I care a lot about. If you look at their ability to save for college, if you look at their ability to pay for health care, you find that those kinds of relative price differences have really hurt them. So it's much more of a mixed bag than all that.
Do you want to get in on this, Scott, at all?
Sure. Well, on the family structure point, you know, I do think that probably the best research that's been done on this is by my colleague Gary Burtless here at Brookings. And he found that not just increases in single parenthood, but also the fact that when people marry, they're much more likely to marry somebody of a similar education level and income level than they were in the past. And those two together could account for something like a third of the rise in inequality. So that's not to say that whole third is family structure, but I do think it's a part of the story. On whether things have improved at the bottom, the research that adjusts for inflation, which all research does, some better than others, take into account the fact that education and healthcare have gotten more expensive. And you know, there's a study by respected economists Bruce Meyer and James Sullivan, which is not the final word on anything, but which finds that actually when you measure things the right way, it looks more like the incomes of the poor have gone up by something like 40% over time, and of the middle, something like 55% over time. Now, these are not the final word on things. As I said, the Congressional Budget Office, you know, says it's 35%. That's not stagnation over a 30-year period.
We're almost out of time. I want to raise two other points really quick, and obviously, listeners, this is a very complicated and vital to this election year conversation that we will have in many ways between now and November on how much inequality of income we have and how much it matters. But, Scott, I want to throw two arguments at you that I've been hearing a lot. One is, obviously, if you have strong growth, the rich get richer and inequality is inevitable but might be tolerable. But I've heard it argued that income inequality can actually impede economic growth. Do you give that any credence?
I am open to being convinced otherwise in the future, but the study that's getting a lot of play right now on that point was done by some economists at the International Monetary Fund. It's a study that looks at developing countries, and so I don't think it's all that relevant for modern countries like the U.S. The best study I know of was actually done by my dissertation advisor, Christopher Jenks. He looked at industrialized countries over the 20th century and found no relationship between changes in inequality and changes in economic growth. So I think this is another case where the evidence, you know, if anything, works against the argument that inequality is dragging us down.
And what about non-economic impacts of income inequality? People argue that it erodes trust and social cohesion and contributes to the kind of angry polarization in our country that we are in the midst of today, not to mention what the original caller who inspired the segment said, and that is that power to affect political outcomes just gets so concentrated in relatively few hands.
I think in terms of the culture and trust and things like that, you know, there's just not a lot of evidence that income inequality is a prominent concern, political concern, of Americans. It certainly has been more of a concern the last few months, and I think that's related to the fact that we just had an incredibly difficult recession and that we're still trying to slog through a recovery. But, you know, inequality has been increasing for 30 years, and Occupy Wall Street, you know, only gained traction here in the last 6 months or so. So I don't think that it's something that's really that much on the minds of day-to-day people. In terms of political power, I think, you know, I could be persuaded, but I don't think there's very strong evidence. The one that's most cited shows that senators are more responsive to their constituents when they're upper income, but it relies on a measure of self-identified ideology, and if upper income people are more educated about political events and issues, then that's going to sort of bake into those findings that there'll be a stronger relationship between if they say they're liberal or conservative.
Jared, come back on any of that.
Okay, so I was kind of with Scott until the end. There's no question that politics is responsive to money, and if Scott wants to, you know, poke holes at studies that say that, you know, good luck. And in fact, I think if anything, it's clear that that's getting worse. You know, we now live in a country where one person, literally one person, and this is as a result of Citizens United, can keep a candidate in a national primary based on their riches, and so you know, that's patently a problem. Look, on inequality. quality and growth, I pretty much agree with Scott's assessment, except for one thing, and it's actually very topical and I think important. This new book out called Why Nations Fail is important in this regard. And what its hypothesis is, and it goes back to ancient Rome, so it's a fairly extensive survey. And it's a little different than, you know, this more narrow question that Scott, I think, was correctly answering, having to do with tentative kinds of correlations between inequality and growth. What it shows is that when society ends up being very extractive and exclusionary, very high levels of growth reaching only those at the top, it's kind of a recipe for failure in the sense that you're no longer generating a more equitable access for ideas, for innovation, for people all throughout the income scale to make a contribution to society, and that's what tends to bring societies down. That has a kind of resonance to me. It's not the kind of lock-solid proof that you might want if I could show you a convincing correlation between the growth and inequality and diminished growth. You don't see that in the advanced economies, like Scott said. What you do see is that when you enter levels of concentration, income concentration that we're talking at, you begin to see dysfunctional politics. Well, we've got that. You begin to see an inability to kind of correct your course, to correctly diagnose and prescribe solutions. We've got that at the federal level. So I think it's a mistake to kind of be too narrow in your scope and, you know, start saying, well, you know, this political study doesn't quite show the influence of money in politics. You know, that's kind of a Rome-burning philosophy in my view.
Well, unfortunately, we're not going to settle this here today. Surprise, surprise. But we had a big piece of the conversation, and I want to thank Jared Bernstein, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, previously Vice President Biden's Chief Economist and Executive Director of President Obama's Task Force on the Middle Class, and Scott Winship, Economic Studies Fellow at the Brookings Institution, previously the Research Manager for the Pew Charitable Trust Economic Mobility Project. They will be debating this question tonight under the auspices of the Manhattan Institute. How much does income inequality matter? Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we continue our April series with Gridlock Sam Schwartz on his grand redesign for the streets of New York. Today, it's the proper place for bicycles and pedestrians. Stay with us.